recommended reading for today, Susan Whitehall's story about Lester Bangs in today's Detroit News. Does the name Lester Bangs ring a bell? Bangs was a key figure at Detroit's Cream magazine, which was a rock music magazine that was a must-read if you were really serious about music in the 70s or so. And her column revisits Philip Seymour Hoffman's portrayal of Lester Bangs in the movie Almost Famous, which I'm sure you've seen. She claims Hoffman nailed it, by the way, which probably doesn't surprise you. It's current state here on WKAR. Later this hour, Melissa Benmark on this weekend's MSU Symphony performance of Copland and Brahms. They're doing Appalachian Spring. And we'll learn about Zero Day, an organization with an office here in Lansing doing really good work with veterans in our area. That's our Neighbors in Action segment, which happens every Wednesday here on Current State. Our first guest today is leading a grassroots effort to let Michigan voters decide on a part-time legislature this November.
Our legislature cannot solve our economic problems. This is why today I am proposing to correct history and upright our great ship of state and return it to its roots by giving you the opportunity to vote for a part-time legislature.
That's Norman Camerod, a West Michigan business owner who chairs the Committee to Restore Michigan's Part-Time Legislature. The group's calling for a two-month legislative session with salaries of $35,000. Currently, the length of Michigan's legislative sessions vary. It's not uncommon for it to meet fewer than 100 days a year. Work is also done in the representative's home district. Legislators average around $80,000 in annual salary. Mr. Camerod says the move would reduce the influence of lobbyists, force legislators to focus more on genuine public service, and restore the aim of the original state constitution. Critics point to a host of pitfalls, including giving too much authority to the governor, bureaucrats, and, ironically, lobbyists, and severely reducing the pool of qualified candidates. To learn more, we welcome Norm Camerod to Current State. Hi, Norm.
Hi. Great to be here with you and your listeners.
We appreciate it. Tell us a little bit more about how a part-time legislature in Michigan would work, please. We've got a two-month legislative session, salaries cut to $35,000 a year. What else can you add to that?
In a nutshell, we're going to be actually cutting their time in office there in Lansing down to 60 days of regular session per year. That's going to be starting in January 1 and ending on March 1. During that same time, they will only be able to vote on bills instead of, as right now, where they actually develop the bills in these four walls we have in Lansing's capital. Those bills now will be developed under our proposal in the district right in front of us instead of the lobbyists in Lansing. Then, as you said, the legislators' compensation is capped at $35,000 per year for that 60 days. Now, that's $17,000 plus each month that they're there voting. Beyond that, they're back in the district working the same jobs we do and also committing some of their life to public service as was required of them prior to 1963. Then the disclosure of all state payments by the legislators. If they go to Mackinac Island and they go to see their party and they try to build a state for it, guess what? We're going to be able to see it right online under our proposal, and we'll be able to see every dime they're spending. No more hiding expenses behind closed doors as we've been seeing in the past. The bills that they vote on will have to be made public on the Internet 5 days prior before adoption. They cannot sit here and change a bill halfway through mid-session and say, all right, even though we published it in this form, we've just added these words, now it's a different bill. Okay, now you have to put it on the Internet for another 5 days.
When do these bills get debated, Norm?
I'm sorry, say again?
When would these bills be debated?
They're going to be debated in the district, or as far as developed in the district. They'll be debated during that 60 days when they're in the House and Senate. They'll be as far as adopting and talking about the bills at that point, but that's pretty much it. They're voting on these bills primarily while they're in the House and Senate.
And what do you see as the key benefits of this transition?
Oh, my gosh. I would invite your listeners to go to our part-time MI Facebook account, a committee to restore Michigan's legislature's Facebook account, because we had Becky Lockhart out of Utah actually contribute a video that shows all these benefits. But in reality, we're going to be made 100% knowledgeable of what they're voting on. When these legislators are in Lansing and they're voting on bills, I've witnessed it, where a lot of the legislators, the bills come off at a rate of 1,800 bills, according to the Legislative Service Bureau, per year. They only are required to put out one bill. That's just
the budget.
Yeah, that's just the budget.
Now, critics point to a variety of concerns. One is that it will exclude the middle class because they cannot afford to interrupt their jobs for 2 months to go to Lansing. Could you respond to that?
Oh, no. I would reemphasize, look at Becky Lockhart's video. They're going to be able to go, you'll have Joe the plumber that'll be able to participate in this. Right now, the way the system's set up, they're literally being governed by the local party system that's in place right now, and it is a career. These politicians, they are insulated by a $100,000 a year salary and benefit package, and they have absolutely no exposure practically to the districts or society for which they invoke these laws upon. This proposal restores this. We're going to restore this. This isn't something we're fabricating. This is something taken from Michigan's history up until 1963.
You've invoked township supervisors as role models, essentially, for state legislators. Talk to us about that. Why would a township supervisor be something of a role model for how a state legislator should operate?
Well, this is an excellent example, and I've in the past have looked at Allendale Township, Blinden Township, where I live. Both of them, believe it or not, have carpenters that are supervisors on these township boards. Now, Allendale Township is a charter township, quite more lengthy than holding office as a representative. In fact, there's a lot more responsibilities. He has a budget. He has a board. He has roads to maintain. He's actually got water districts that he has to also fund and make sure that are operating properly, and sewer districts. This guy literally does this part-time, and he's a carpenter on the other side of his life. And also in my township, I live in a general law township, more constitutional general law, but in the same token, he's a carpenter, and he does it. He's there maybe 2 or 3 hours every other day, and then he's doing his business as he normally does. This is nothing new. We're not inventing nothing new here. We're basically restoring back what we've had in the past for our legislators. They are also going to be doing the same thing, getting their skin in this game that they're regulating.
Well, some critics fear that it could actually assign more authority and power to lobbyists and bill factories out of Washington, D.C. What do you make of that criticism?
I think it's hoopla. I mean, it's a red herring. In reality, they'll still have the ability to organize themselves under our bill. They'll still have staff in Lansing that'll be no more than 250 staff. But, Mark, I know a lot of people even criticize that aspect. Well, we're reducing staff immensely. John Engler, when he was in office, actually put that legislature on steroids. There was probably 3 to 4 representatives with one secretary prior to John Engler. And John Engler ended up adding staff upon staff, thus creating the Engler machine, as we all heard. That's going to be reduced. First of all, there's a huge reason for this. Representative Bill Huizinga was a state representative. He actually served under Pete Hoekstra. He's a prime example of why we start developing with more and more and more staff. You have this huge machine that starts developing, and the public citizen-driven ideology is taken out as a result of this. We want to encourage.
Do you feel this will promote civic involvement in some way?
Oh, you bet.
How?
Because they're going to be developing these bills, these policies, and doing their research in the field, not in Lansing and in front of a lobbyist. Right now, we have a system where a lobbyist can walk right into a senator or representative's office with a check and a draft legislative piece, which I've witnessed, and virtually the representative picks it up and throws it onto the House floor or in the committee for discussion. I've actually witnessed this and have been victim of it. It's going to take that and change it, and now they're going to actually do it in the field, in the district. In front of us, much like we see wetlands policies developed, or even wetlands districts, or different districts involving waste management with DEQ, where they actually hold public hearings in the field. We're going to, our brown fields and so on. We're going to see that
It often gets reported how few people actually know the name of their state rep or state senator. You feel that this approach will actually raise awareness? It could actually be promote that kind of involvement and awareness.
It will do it as it did prior to 1963 when George Romney brought in the full-time legislature. You will know. I mean, I can remember in my youth, my mom and father knew who their state representative was. Today, my mother couldn't tell me. I even asked her last week, "Do you even know who he is?" And she says, "No, I really don't." It's going to encourage this because they're going to be doing this work in the field, and we're going to know who they are doing it. It's going to have a huge bearing on that.
You need 320-some thousand signatures to get this on the ballot. You've just launched your petition signing effort. Are you getting a lot of support? You getting a lot of skepticism? What?
If I had to weigh it out, Jack Hoogendyk actually ran just an independent poll. Wasn't certified, but he just ran it out on the Internet. Who wants it? 85% of the respondents are saying, "We want it." But what I'm seeing personally is, even on our Facebook page, people are just desperate. They want to see real, real change in Michigan. I'm convinced this present system will not afford us change. I've gone across this whole state, both in Detroit, up north, and I just actually came back in from a little town called St. Louis yesterday. The foreclosures are still running rampant. And the legislature seems to be absolutely immune to this. We need to make them part of it and put their skin in this game.
You're at the State Board of Canvassers tomorrow, Norm. What's happening there?
We're going to be going. The State Bureau of Elections has recommended to the Board of Canvassers to adopt our petition. Basically, it's a formal process where the Board of Canvassers are going to now oversee this and under the Open Meetings Act actually formally adopt our petition, obviously with some input. But once that is completed, the petition's format, and that's what they're going to be looking at, the form, as reviewed by the Bureau of Elections, is going to be complete, and they'll formally adopt it. It's a formal proceeding.
Got it. Norm Kamerad chairs the Committee to Restore Michigan's Part-Time Legislature. Norm, thank you.
It was a pleasure being with you. Thank you so much.
We also decided to take a closer look at how a part-time legislature might play out here in Michigan by studying what happens elsewhere in the country. Here to tell us more, Current State's Kevin Lavery. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good.
Well, if governing nearly 10 million people with a legislature that meets for just 2 months sounds impossible, then I would invite you to take a trip down I-75 and spend some time in the Peach State. Georgia is the eighth most populous state in the country, just slightly ahead of us here in Michigan. We're number 9. They have a state legislature that convenes also in January, but it will wrap up business by early April. Lawmakers there meet for just 40 days, but not necessarily consecutively. I spoke with Paul Yates about state politics in Atlanta. He's a contributing reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting, and I asked him about term limits, which apply to Michigan lawmakers, but not in Georgia.
Well, the argument here is that a lack of term limits helps in that it allows lawmakers to gain experience and knowledge and institutional memory that can benefit the state long term. Of course, there is the danger as to legislators becoming entrenched and being heedless of their constituents. The argument here is that lawmakers who are in place for some time still have to answer to their constituents every few years and thereby are held accountable.
One of the concerns is that part-time legislators would not really have enough time to learn the issues. There's a feeling that lobbyists and other special interest groups could really take advantage of that and coerce them into crafting policies that favor them. Has Georgia had a similar experience, and are there safeguards there against that?
Well, there has been significant concern through the years in this state that lobbyists and others have undue influence on Georgia's part-time legislature. The state legislature here has always been part-time, meeting for 40 days and nights, but they can, of course, stop the clock at any given time. So generally, the session begins in January and goes for roughly a period of 4 months, although that can be less or more depending on the issues. But the concern has been among good government groups of all stripes that the part-time legislature is unduly influenced by lobbyists and others with an agenda. And there has been concern at the same time that money is a factor because these lawmakers here make a small amount, only about $17,000 a year, that they are susceptible to gifts and other influence. The state has moved in recent years to implement new rules and limitations on gifts from lobbyists and disclosure of lobbyist spending. And so the transparency piece is a big part of an effort here to maintain the aura, at least, of open government.
Paul, what happens near the end of your legislative session there in Georgia when the budget bills are coming due? One would think that because of such a shortened session, at least relatively in the eyes of Michiganders here, there probably isn't a lot of room for lawmakers to have their pet projects, to have a lot of pork. They got to be very disciplined.
Exactly. And it's certainly in recent years here, as I'm sure has been the case in Michigan, there's been no room for pork. There has been an era of tight budgets that's descended on this state, certainly, like has not been seen in many, many years. And so that makes it easier on the budget writers and legislative leaders, certainly on the governor in many respects. They can just say no to everyone. This year, for the first time in some time, there is more money to spend. And so as a consequence, there are more people with their hands out, as it were, and that causes some headaches. And the discipline of a 40-day session gives these lawmakers, in terms of leadership positions, the opportunity to say, we're done, this is the way it will be, and we're wrapping this up.
40 days is not a long stretch of time for any profession, let alone lawmakers. And again, for just $17,000 a year, how does Georgia attract new lawmakers, new blood, especially without term limits, and attracting skilled lawmakers?
Well, some might say that only the truly dedicated would want to do this, especially for the low pay. And there, of course, there is a negative connotation that goes along with that as well, that the hands come out and this is an opportunity for those who are seeking power and aggrandizement and perhaps a ticket to a better financial future. The opposing view is that with the low pay and part-time mandate, you only attract the truly dedicated, those who really want to be here and make this work.
I imagine that's a good theory. Does that really work in practice, though?
It works in practice on a certain level. There are a number of lawmakers here. Some of them, courtesy of the lack of term limits, have been here for many years, who are known and respected for their knowledge and their selfless efforts on behalf of the state. And of course, there are others that don't bring that to mind.
We talked a bit earlier about the influence of lobbyists, special interest groups. I wonder if we ever see influence from these lawmakers' employers in their regular full-time jobs. Certainly many of them are going to be self-employed, lawyers and farmers, et cetera. But do we ever see the temptation from their businesses, their employers, to influence peddle?
Without question, that's a major concern of government watchdog groups here and, of course, elsewhere. In this state, there has been no restriction on your employment vis-a-vis your work on a given committee. So you'll have a banker on the banks and banking committee, an insurance agent on the insurance committee, and all of the potential for conflict there. The argument is this is all on the table. There is new transparency like never before. that spells that out, and if someone goes astray, it will quickly become known. But that remains a source of contention, certainly here in Georgia.
Is there a takeaway here for Michigan lawmakers? Are there lessons to be learned or advice about staying away from the pitfalls?
Well, the system here in Georgia, proponents would argue, has a number of benefits, certainly involving the cost of government and the taxation of citizens in the state and the effect that that has commensurately on attracting new business and development to the state. The Republican leadership here will tell you that the system in place here is fostering growth across the board in new business recruitment and other areas, and they will tell you that the less time lawmakers are here coming up with new laws, the better off constituents are in the state, and the cost of government reflects that. But of course, there are the dangers, as we've discussed, that part-time lawmakers are open to undue influence, including financial influence.
Paul Yates is a contributing reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting covering the state legislature in Atlanta. Paul, thank you so much for having time for us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Labrie.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. The MSU Symphony Orchestra's next concert is Friday night at Wharton Center. It features the fourth and last symphony of Brahms and Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring. And Current State's Melissa Benmark is here to tell us more. Hi, Melissa.
Hey there, Mark Bayshore. Had a nice talk with Kevin Noe recently about the program, and I had assumed going into this that the Appalachian Spring version would be the full orchestrated form, and they're actually going to be performing the original small orchestra piece. So I talked to Kevin Noe about how that was different from the more probably more often performed orchestral work.
Believe it or not, I have never done the big symphony orchestra version. I know the little one, the 13-instrument one, quite well. I've done that two or three times. And I think it brings a level of intimacy and a special kind of communicative quality that I think is rare in any work, regardless of the size of the piece. I think in many ways that's one of the most extraordinary American offerings that we have. I don't know what more a person could ask from a piece of music than Appalachian Spring gives you.
I wonder sometimes, looking at the story of it, he knew he was writing a ballet for Martha Graham, and people have said, you so convey the sense of the Appalachian Mountains and everything, and it doesn't sound like he necessarily was looking at doing that. I wonder if the fact that how it was being conceived has meant that whoever hears it kind of assigns their own images to it.
Well, I think that's always that way in music, right? I mean, Stravinsky always said that music is in and of itself its own kind of emotional and artistic form, and any other kind of linking that we do where it reminds us of something else, that's all good and well, but that's entirely our own doing that we thrust that on it. So I suppose that's true, but there is something so immediately, deeply American about Appalachian Spring in particular. This is true of all of Copland's music. I just did Billy the Kid a couple weeks ago, and it certainly has that flavor to it, but it does have a little bit more of a caricature of the Old West quality. Appalachian Spring has something that's so profoundly American that I find myself constantly struggling with the right words to articulate why. It seems so me. You know, and I know I'm not alone. I mean, many people hear that piece and they feel that they immediately understand it. I mean, whatever understanding music is, I don't know that I understand any of it, you know what I mean? But Appalachian Spring certainly comes the closest to feeling like it was written as a part of me somehow, of maybe any piece I've ever been around.
What part of the piece do you find the most intriguing?
Well, actually, in this particular case, it's the process. I mean, this is a very unique project for us. It's only 13 players, and this was a volunteer group and by audition only. and the group is doing something quite extraordinary. They're playing the entire piece from memory, and we're rehearsing from memory. And the group is only rehearsing with scores. They only bring the full score of the whole piece to rehearsal, so everybody's aware of what everybody else has. And we rehearse that way now, and we're close. I mean, we've got it, the whole thing from memory, and people are standing while they play. People can move. If people have a duet, the violin and the flute have a little duet. They can walk and stand right next to each other while they play it. People are moving all over the place and communicating, and there are no stands involved, so there's no block between one person and the next. All the visual contact is eye to eye, or maybe in this case, heart to heart, you know. And I think it has brought something so extraordinary, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, it's been one of the most joyous rehearsal processes I've ever been a part of, and I'm extremely proud of these musicians for putting in the extra time to make this an extraordinary thing. And we're planning on doing it here on this February 7th show. We're working on, hopefully, the possibility of doing it again on a March 24th show at Fairchild Theater, which would be a crossover show, which would be half Appalachian Spring and half jazz students improvising in part on themes of Appalachian Spring. And we're going to record this soon in Fairchild as well, so we have a memento of this time in our lives when we chose to carve out that much time and really dig into it. And I'm just thrilled to be a part of it. I think anybody who's ever heard a group play from memory after they've put that kind of care into it, it's exceedingly rare, and I think you can hear something special. I do a lot of works from memory. About the only pieces I ever conduct with a score are concertos for complex reasons. So that's not unusual for me. But to have the whole group learn the whole piece from memory, that's a very different kind of thing. Now, you're accustomed to hearing a concerto soloist, you know, would very often play from memory. But many people that I've talked to that are doing the Appalachian Spring, who have, of course, also played concertos from memory, say that it's actually much easier to memorize something like that because you're always playing the subject. You're always playing the main thing. And you don't have these rests, and then you just play a few little notes that are just a part of a decoration of somebody else's thing. Everything has this wonderful front and center quality to it. And when you're playing background and you're just playing the same note for eight bars and then two bars of rest and then, you know, a little something or other, that's tricky. You know, that's tricky because it comes up differently each time, and Copeland's particularly crafty about keeping us on our feet and changing little things, so it's hard to remember. But in many ways, the payoff, I would say, it doesn't come from a concerto soloist playing from memory. They could play with the score, and I'm not sure it would change the things that much. But when you have 13 people all communicating with each other and they're all playing from memory and every little nuance counts back and forth, anyway, it's a marvelous project.
The Brahms Symphony No. 4, his last symphony, a guy that didn't even think he was capable of writing the symphony. Talk about the experience of conducting that.
Well, it's my first time with Brahms 4. Obviously, it's one of those pieces that people know. You know, you hear it done a lot for a good reason, but it's my first time studying it. I feel like I'm really close to 2 and 3, and this is my first time with 4. It feels quite different to me. It feels like a different sort of animal. This one is very sort of tightly crafted. You know, I find in 2 and 3, Brahms is more prone to wander off in fantasia land for a few bars and then come back. Whereas in this particular case, I think he's tried to ratchet it down from a compositional standpoint so that everything relates to everything else and it keeps the form and the kind of intensity really taut. So the impact of the thing has this very dense, that's the word, a very dense kind of impact, you know, in the way that, for example, a piece like Daphnis and Chloe that I'm going to do in a couple weeks doesn't have that density. I mean, it's equally wonderful, but there are more perforations in the sound. Do you know what I mean? So something about that density I think is really interesting, and I don't know that he could have done that route any better than he did, you know. I mean, he explored every possible way of mining a very small amount of material and extracting from it a whole piece, and I think, obviously, he did a great job.
Well, Kevin Noe, thanks for talking to us about the music, and good luck with the concert.
Always a pleasure talking with you.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. The American legal system is littered with ancient Latin terms. Phrases like habeas corpus, ex post facto, and pro bono are common in our courts. So common, in fact, that many of us who are not lawyers and judges have some idea what they mean. But imagine trying to grasp what's happening in a courtroom when English is not your first language. At best, the experience can be stressful and even frightening without an interpreter. The Michigan Supreme Court is looking for people to fulfill that role. Here's Current State's Kevin Lavery again with more. What's going on, Kevin?
Mark, how are you? It's been so long. Well, there's a new rule now that requires all the courts in the state of Michigan to provide interpreters to so-called LEP parties. That stands for Limited English Proficiency. I sat down with Justice Bridget McCormick of the Michigan Supreme Court. She chairs the committee that's tasked with certifying court interpreters, and she says the issue has been simmering for years.
Actually, it's an issue that the court had been investigating for some years, long before I arrived here. We should credit my predecessor, Justice Marilyn Kelly, with getting the ball rolling on looking into what the Supreme Court could do to make sure that we provided meaningful, consistent access to language services across the state. There are actually lots of courts in our state that were doing an excellent job on this issue, but there are some places where it was imperfect or could be improved. And as the Supreme Court, we want to make sure that we're providing meaningful, consistent access to language services all around the state. So after publishing some draft rules and getting feedback from the community and feedback from the courts, we got around to finally passing this rule in September and made it immediately effective so that every court in the state has the same rule to provide meaningful and consistent access to limited English proficient individuals.
What were some of the courts around Michigan telling you and your peers on the high court about the challenges they were facing when anyone, a plaintiff, defendant, whomever, was coming into court and was just having a language barrier problem?
Yeah, it's really an important access to justice issue, and that's what, you know, frankly, I feel like all of the judges that work in our courts and our courts are focused on is making sure that everybody who comes to court both can understand what's going on and be understood. I mean, frankly, this is as much of an issue for the judges and the lawyers as it is for the people who are having a harder time communicating, because the judges and the court administrators and the lawyers, they want to understand what those people have to say, whether they're parties or witnesses, or sometimes family members. You know, making sure that people can understand but also be understood makes our system of justice work. It's just kind of a basic tenet of our justice system.
Going back to the idea of uniform standards and consistency, certainly our courts are locally funded, generally at the county level. So I'm sure that many are doing the best they can, but to what degree are we really seeing them make the investment on their own rather than having to be told to do so?
You know, that's a great question, and it's one I don't have any specific answer to because we've never really collected data on this topic, although we are hoping to now that we have a statewide standard, we are hoping to get data, at least from the seven counties where this issue comes up the most. From what we understand, there are some counties where they were already budgeting and covering this service aggressively, and this new rule isn't going to impose any new costs on them at all. There will obviously be other courts where they may have been figuring out how to make ends meet, if you will, in their LEP litigation without certified interpreters or qualified interpreters, and so this will increase their cost. That's got to be true. We don't yet know to what extent, but we hope to know something more about that in the coming months, because we are trying to collect some data.
Is it common practice for courts to tell defendants and plaintiffs, you've got to provide your own interpreter? And I can see opportunity for conflict of interest. I can see maybe in a civil case, a child custody case, for example, the plaintiff or the defendants hires their significant other or a family member. Is that part of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, that's a big focus of this rule. I mean, really, in addition to making sure that the access is meaningful and consistent across the state, it's also that the interpretation they're getting is the kind that we feel is good enough that we're doing right by them. So in addition to standardizing practices, if you will, the rule regulates who's qualified to interpret, who's even higher than that, certified to interpret. We are aggressively recruiting additional people to become certified so that when courts use those folks, they know that they're delivering, you know, quality interpretation. The example you raise is exactly the kind of example that made this court feel like this was an issue we had to do something about, because we heard, you know, ad hoc stories. These were not I don't think this was commonplace, but we would hear stories of kids interpreting for parents in child custody disputes, a domestic violence victim having to have her batterer interpret for her. Those are the kinds of stories we want to make sure don't ever happen again. And so that's the kind of thing that this rule will fix, we think.
And how is this rule also designed not just for the person at the center of this, but how does it really protect the integrity of the court, other people, other parties in the court?
As important it is for an LEP party or witness to understand what's happening in a court procedure or even in court pleadings or forms, it's just as important that the judges and the opposing parties or opposing counsel understand what the LEP party or witness has to say about what's going on. I mean, we want to make sure that we are providing justice for everybody, and to do that, we need to make sure everybody is not just able to understand, but also understood.
Is there any way to tell, Justice McCormick, if this issue has impeded the administration of justice? I'd like to think that by the time a case gets to your level, the ultimate level in the state of Michigan, that somewhere along the way, if there was an error or a problem, somebody would have declared a mistrial or something.
Yeah, and I think that actually does happen. It's frankly not very efficient, because if a trial court, you know, has invested some number of months and so many hours in a proceeding before it comes to the court's attention that a party or a witness has not been able to understand what's been at issue, the trial court's likely to declare a mistrial, because that's probably what has to be done. And that's a waste of resources and, you know, not fair to the parties and the witnesses on both sides of that dispute, frankly. So by tackling this issue at the front end and making sure our courts are, you know, providing consistent access, I also think we will be more efficient. There will be ways in which the rule will save money.
This rule mainly addresses civil cases, custody and property and eviction, things like that. But should this be brought into the criminal law side of things? Or is it already being addressed adequately?
You know, actually, it's an interesting question. My sense from what we were hearing is that the criminal dockets were way ahead of the civil dockets on providing qualified interpreters, in large part because there are a number of other due process issues at stake in those cases. But the rule applies to every case in the state. It applies to every case in every court.
And again, will counties have to shoulder this cost on their own? Is there federal grant money, state assistance money that could help lower courts handle this?
That's beyond my pay grade. My understanding is some of the big counties are not going to see any increase at all, because they've already been providing maybe even more services than the rule requires. So it's not going to be an issue. To the extent that other counties incur new costs, I am hopeful that our legislature would see this as a valuable place to put some resources, and always interested in any other access to funding for this kind of issue. So
what is the process then if someone wants to become a certified language interpreter for the court system in the state of Michigan?
Well, thank you for asking. We really are encouraging as many people as possible to become certified interpreters. They will then be put on our list of certified interpreters and be used in our courts throughout the state. The process is a two-step exam process. Candidates have to pass a written English exam to be eligible to take an oral proficiency exam. Both exams take place here at the Hall of Justice. And if you're interested, you can call 517-373-6670 or send an email to languageaccess@courts.mi.gov and find out when we're testing, and please come take the test.
Justice Bridget McCormick is a member of the Michigan Supreme Court and also the chair of the High Court's Limited English Proficiency Implementation Advisory Committee. Justice McCormick, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. It is Wednesday, which means it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, when we feature people and organizations working to make the Lansing area a better place. Today we feature Zero Day, a Lansing-based nonprofit that provides employment training and supportive services to local veterans. Here to tell us more, Chuck Ems, a co-founder of Zero Day. Hi, Chuck.
Hello, sir.
And Anthony Burkett, who is a veteran and a participant in the Zero Day program. Hi, Anthony.
How you doing, sir?
Welcome to both of you to Current State. Chuck, tell us about Zero Day. What do you do?
Well, Zero Day was established as a community revitalization organization using veteran labor. A little bit embarrassed to admit, I'm a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force Reserves, and in October of 2012, I was one of my employees came to me and said, "Geez, Chuck, did you know that on any given night there's 60 plus homeless veterans at the Volunteers of America shelter right here in Lansing?" And I was embarrassed. I didn't. I lived 5 miles from it, and I had no idea. I'd driven by it 100 times. So really, that was the genesis of Zero Day, is that I thought I had to get in there and I had to try to do something.
That many?
That many.
60 to 70 on one night.
On any given
Amazing.
Night, all year around. So I went down there. I toured the facility. Volunteers of America does a wonderful job helping out the folks that need that little push in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I struggled and trying to figure out how we could actually make a difference. And I ran into a social acquaintance of mine, Tim Honeycutt, and I was explaining to him, ironically, at a high school football game. I just started laying it out to him what was heavy on my heart. As I told him the story, Tim looked at me and says, "Geez, Chuck, when I was with the Department of Corrections, I was put in charge of a program called the Prison Build Program to help prisoners come out and find employment." So Tim, for many years in the Department of Corrections, taught prisoners how to build houses. He is an expert in development and construction, historical preservation. So he looked at me, he says, "Chuck, I've done it with prisoners. I'd love to do it with veterans."
We can do it with veterans. Amazing. Anthony, describe your situation before you connected with Zero Day.
Well, I'm originally from Flint, and I had a situation where I let my cousin had knocked on my door at 4 o'clock in the morning, February the 10th of 2013. And when I let him in, he pistol with me, shot me in the head, he shot me in my shoulder, and he stole my pension fund money. I've been doing asbestos for 17 years, and I got a pension fund from Local 207. It's lead and abatement union out of Detroit, and he robbed me for $8,000, which made me homeless. So my father wanted me to get away from Flint, so I went up to Lansing. My brother told me about the VOA. I talked to Emily, who was in charge of the letting people in, and I told her my situation, and they let me in with open arms. The VOA is definitely a place where if you are a veteran that don't have nowhere to live, they will bring you in with open arms and help you as much as they can.
And this attack was less than a year ago. We're coming up on the first anniversary of this attack, which really changed everything. Chuck, do you have a pretty close working relationship with the VOA since so many veterans seek services there?
We talk often, and most of the participants in Zero Day have come from the Volunteers of America. Like Anthony heard about us and showed up one day and said, "You know, I'm ready to kickstart my life here." And really, you know, Zero Day is about getting the veterans well and then getting them stable. The wellness piece, you know, typically the people believe wellness means there's been combat trauma or something
right.
of that nature. But wellness, what we were finding out was more life skills and you know, things had happened in their lives like Anthony or just divorce or something that caused them, usually financial strife, that they just couldn't dig out of. So we help get them well. We have counselors and therapists on staff that help them with the wellness piece. And the stability piece was, let's get them on a work crew. Let's get them back working with people, feeling good. Our whole purpose is to try to give them a sense of purpose and let them live with dignity. Start earning a paycheck. It's not a welfare benefit. We don't give them anything for free. They work their butts off. And so when someone like Anthony shows up and says, I'm ready to take ownership of my life here and I want to work for it, mm-hmm. I mean, he's kind of our star pupil, and just very proud of him. And Anthony and I are good friends now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Excellent. What's the last year been like? What have you been doing exactly?
Well, I got with a Zero Day in May of last year, and I got on the crew. We did some Ingham County Land Bank jobs all the way through the summer. Through Zero Day, I learned how to reevaluate my life, not pity myself, because you're around nothing but military. So they motivate you and they keep you going, whatever you're going through. I've got my driver's license. I've got my state asbestos license. I know how to lay concrete. I know how to roof. I know how to build houses. I know how to redo houses from the inside. All that I learned through Zero Day.
What's been the biggest challenge for you, Anthony?
The biggest challenge for me is basically mental and emotional and psychological, not letting what happened to me dictate my future. And the more that I got people around me like Chuck and Tim and Craig and my Zero Day brothers, my situation has made it a lot better, mm-hmm. and a lot easier.
Chuck, do you have relationships with area employers then?
We do. We are actually an employer ourselves. It's not our intent to grow a huge company with lots of employees. Once we get the veterans well and stable, we do want to get them into an area of something that they're passionate about. They want to own a Jimmy John's, let them own a Jimmy John's. We'll help them figure that out. But we do have partner employers. For example, we have an asbestos abatement company that Anthony's working for now. Several of our veterans are working for now, making a higher wage. And just, again, it's a stepping stone. We get a lot of, as Anthony mentioned, the Ingham County Land Bank has given us a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, one of the biggest issues with community revitalization is blight elimination. So we have a lot of houses around the Lansing area that are, you know, falling apart. They're an eyesore, but they're also a spot for, you know, unscrupulous activity that takes a lot of the resources, police and fire. So taking care of those properties, whether we demolish them or we fix them up, you know, that's something that we're focused on, and the land bank has been wonderful.
How many veterans are you serving, are you working with right now?
Right now, I think we have six that are working full-time on the payroll.
What's been the biggest challenge here in just getting this program off and running?
Well, the biggest challenge has been the wellness piece. At any given time, we have had upwards of 30 veterans that we're trying to get well enough to put on a crew and actually get out to the job site or in an academic environment,
okay.
where we can teach them skills. Some of them just can't get out of that wellness piece. But that's the beauty of Zero Day is that, you know, Anthony can come back anytime. Even though he's working for someone else, he can come back anytime. If he's struggling with something, he can come back and talk with us. So we keep that wellness piece alive for our veterans for the rest of their life if they want to come back.
And most of the time, it is the psychological, emotional dimension when you talk about wellness.
Absolutely.
Okay. Any new and where does your funding come from?
Well, when we first started, it was privately funded with Tim and I, and since then, you know, the work that we do, we actually get paid for, and we've had some organizations in and around the state. The Michigan Economic Development Corp, Mr. Finney and Mr. Durian over there, have been a wonderful partner for us. They have some programs there that are eligible, not specifically to veterans, but helping structurally unemployed folks around the state of Michigan. They've been a huge help on that side.
Anthony, what's it been like to work in such close proximity with so many fellow veterans? I mean, you alluded earlier to the fact that you really do reinforce each other. Tell us more about that.
Well, we mow like a family. You know what I'm saying? It's not like you go, when we go come to work, we work, and then when you go all your separate ways. We concerned with each other at work and not at work. You know what I'm saying? We call each other. We talk to each other. You know what I'm saying? There's been situations where different type of people been going through different type of problems. And we sit down and we talk to them. And it's always positive. You know what I'm saying?
It's a real culture that you've created. Yeah,
and it's sincerely, it's family. It really is. It's family. We see each other. We see each other out and about. We call each other brothers. You know what I'm saying? It's not just you, my coworker, but we brothers. And it's easier to work with somebody that you can get along with than to work with somebody that you just tolerating.
You're working with six right now, Chuck. I mean, how many would you like to be working with? There's an awful lot more that can't get through the wellness hurdle, get over the wellness hurdle. But you're equipped to help an awful lot more?
Well, we control that because the work is limited. So having 25 people on a job site might be counterproductive to what we're trying to do.
Okay.
We also have a learning piece of this too, learning the trade skills, because it's not something you can just throw someone out there and say, you know, geez, we hope you don't, you know, hurt yourself. So there's a safety aspect to it. So typically between 6 and 10 is what we have on a crew. And in a variety of jobs also.
And if people want to support you and what you're doing, how can people get involved?
Our website. I know everyone's got a website. zero-day.us. We have a section on there to donate. We have a section on there to volunteer. Volunteerism is something that we could really use a heavy dose of. It's a business. I have a full-time job. Tim's out on the sites working with the veterans every day. So we have a lot of administrative and even, you know, construction type jobs that we could use some help with.
We commend you both. It's been fascinating to learn about it. Chuck Ems, co-founder of Zero Day. Anthony Burkett is a participant in the program and a former veteran. Thanks to both of you for taking the time to join us today, and good luck.
Thank you, sir.
Now we have a little Neighbors in Action bonus segment. The local dental practice of Portnoy and Two is participating in the American Dental Association's Give Kids a Smile program, and they're offering free dental services to kids this Friday. On the phone to give us more information, office manager Deb Black of Portnoy and Two Dental in Okemos. Hi, Deb.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Well, we're excited for Friday. We've done this a couple years now, and we are trying to fill the need of children ages 2 to 12 that fall through the cracks in our society. Kids that have Medicaid, kids that have commercial insurance, have access to dental needs, where the kids that the parents are just working to survive, they don't have the extra money to buy the insurance. So we're going to try to help those kids out. We're not asking. All they have to tell us is they don't have insurance, and they're free to come in.
And where's your practice?
We are at 1738 Hamilton Road in Okemos, right off of Grand River and Dobie.
Have you ever done anything like this before?
Yes, we did it last year. We really feel the need to contribute to our community. We want to give back, and of course with children, you know, they touch the heart of all of us, and that's why we do what we do.
Appointments necessary, Deb?
Yes, or? Appointments are necessary. I do have openings. So if they'll call as soon as possible at 517-349-3266 and ask for myself, Deb, then I'll get them all set up and tell them, you know, they can fill out the paperwork when they get here.
Okay. Deb Black, very nice to visit with you. Deb's office manager at Portnoy and Two Dental Practice in Okemos, where they are offering free children's dental services this Friday at their clinic on Hamilton Road, 349-3266. Thank you, Deb. Good
You're
luck.
Welcome. Thank you.
Sure.
Bye now.
Current state could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there doing excellent work. We need to find out about them. Please help us out. Tweet us at KAR Current State, or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the work they do. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, Budget Director John Nixon. The state budget comes out today. We'll see you then. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR.